Brother Jerry's title is The Great Passover. The Great Passover. Brother Jerry Leslie.
Thank you, Brother Bob. It is a pleasure to enjoy your fellowship at this convention, and even a greater pleasure that both Sharon and Aaron could join me this year. We could be here as a family. And also, especially, that so many of our class could be here also. We have a number of brethren that, from our little class in Portland that are here. We love you very much, and those also that remain in Portland expressed their love for you and ask that the text in Proverbs 14:26 be sent to you. In the fear of the Lord is strong confidence, and his children have a place of refuge. The lessons of history have a profound influence on our lives. We can look back into the lessons of history and find principles that we can live by. But also, there is a significance in the platform that history lays. I think that there is no nation in the world that makes decisions without looking back into their history and making decisions that will correct past mistakes or build on the successes of the past and to enhance them. So the lessons of history for countries and nations have an effect and have a determinative effect upon the future. In our lessons today, we will touch on some lessons from Kings and Chronicles, and we will mention some dates, not for the purpose of establishing or proving those dates, but to give you a sort of a mental timeline and the relative position of some of these events and their sequence. Remember that when we are talking about BC dates, that the timeline diminishes towards the AD-BC boundary. And so as the numbers get smaller, we are progressing forward in time. We find our lesson in the declining years of Israel's integrity as a nation. From an originally deeply committed and devoted people, subjects to God's instructions. From a nation led in the wilderness by Moses and wise counselors, from a nation that was counseled by only judges at first, that routed its enemies, it soon fell into the ways of the Gentiles, desiring kings and the symbols of worldly credibility. In the days before Jeroboam and Rehoboam, the nation divided under the heavy hand of oppressive rule to select their own kings and their own capitals. This was followed by the northern kingdom, in the northern kingdom, by mostly compromising kings and idolatry. In 750 BC, Samaria, the capital of the ten tribes, fell to the Assyrians, and many of the population were deported to Assyria. Shalmaneser besieged Samaria for 3 years, then stopped short of taking the southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. In 745 BC, Hezekiah came to the throne of Judah. He showed himself courageous, as we were reminded yesterday, to follow after the ways that God appointed. His first act of government was to abolish every form of idolatry. The worship of Baal was broken up. The temple had fallen into disrepair, and the doors were shut. He opened and cleansed the temple and rededicated the priests. The appropriate Passover time had just passed in the cleansing process. So Hezekiah availed himself of the second month provision noted in Numbers 9, 6 through 13. Invitations were also sent to Judah and the remnant of Israel in the north. And some even came to that Passover from the north. 2 Chronicles 30, verse 6. Hezekiah, having seen the demise of the northern kingdom of Israel in the siege of Sargon and Shalmaneser against Samaria, knew that his southern kingdom of Judah was in a most vulnerable position and perhaps not far behind. 2 Kings 19, verse 11. Behold, thou hast heard what the kings of Assyria have done in all lands by destroying them utterly. And shalt thou be delivered? So he strengthened the defenses of Jerusalem and built a tunnel to bring the fresh water of the Gihon within the city walls at Siloam. Hezekiah reigned 29 years. And in his 14th year, Sennacherib came up against Jerusalem with great boasting of Assyria's conquests. Hezekiah had now fallen sick with a grave illness. Unable to lead the nation through the dilemma, he prayed for a sign that is noted in 2 Chronicles 32 and also in 2 Kings, the 19th and 20th chapters. In response to this prayer, the sun was turned backward 10 degrees, and Isaiah prophesied that 15 more years would be added to his life. In other words, Hezekiah would not experience his demise at this low point in his life. Amidst these momentous events, a terrible pestilence fell on the Assyrian camp, and they departed without a full victory. 2 Chronicles 32, 21, and 2 Kings 19, 35, and 36. But this Passover season celebrated by Hezekiah is not the one that we want to feature today. Hezekiah's successor was Manasseh, whose 55-year reign was Jerusalem's longest and one of the worst. Manasseh established paganism and even permitted fertility rites and cultic prostitution to take place inside the temple. The purge of Hezekiah evaporated so quickly. Judah, though retaining a king, was now a vassal state to Assyria and paid high tributes. We can be sure Assyria approved the license of such corrupting practices in this vassal kingdom. The experience shows how ready the human nature is to fall to its base elements when those in authority promote its legitimacy. How few stand apart for moral and spiritual disciplines amidst the tide of popularity. And it is a lesson for our day to stand for principle and righteousness. Toward the end of his reign, Manasseh had some misgivings, and he did attempt some reforms, but it was too little, too late. The gates of approval had been opened, and now reform could only be imposed, but not inspired. In 661 BC, his son Amon took the throne and also forsook the God of his fathers, 2 Kings 21 and also the 33rd chapter of 2 Chronicles. Assyria was an aging empire and was preoccupied with the growing assertiveness of Babylon. While Amon collaborated with Assyria, Judah was restless of domination and reached for greater independence. There were contesting bids for power, and a conspiracy had him slain. And his young son, Josiah. Josiah will be the focus of our lesson today. Was 8 years old. And he was promoted to the throne in 659 BC. There may have been plans to groom this young lad for the liberality of his father's morals in the new spirit of political independence that was rising in the land. Few anticipated the apparent strong influence, however, of his mother. For Josiah followed not in the way of his father, but followed the tradition of King David. 2 Kings 22, the first two verses we will read. 2 Kings 22, 1 and 2. Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jedidiah, the daughter of Adiah of Boscath. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, and walked in all the way of David his father, and turned not aside to the right hand or to the left. I think this is a testimony, it's an epitaph of one's life that we will see. His mother's name indicates that she was of a godly parentage. Jedidiah signifies the beloved of Jehovah. And her mother, the king's grandmother, her name was Adiah, the honored of Jehovah. From such good parental stock, on the maternal side at least, we should expect the foundation of a good character, and it was so. 2 Chronicles 34, verse 3. For in the 8th year of his reign, when he was yet young, he began to seek after the God of David his father. And in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem from the high places and the groves and the carved images and the molten images. And this purging process is mentioned in the next three or four verses, verses 4 through 7. Josiah's 16th year dates his conversion, when he began to seek after the God of David. He began to reign when he was 8 years old, and these events are recorded in his 8th year of his reign. He was 16 years old. He began to seek after the God of David. It is one thing to be well born, but quite another to consecrate the heart to the Lord. It is not sufficient that we be well disposed, moral. It is necessary that we become the Lord's, devoting ourselves wholly to his will. And this Josiah did. The result of the king's thus seeking the Lord culminated 4 years later, when he was 20 years old, in a determination to use his influence and power for the complete overthrow of idolatry throughout the kingdom. The next 6 years of his reign were devoted to this work. He pursued it not only in Jerusalem and throughout Judah, but even extended his influence over a large portion that had been the 10 tribes' dominion in the north. 2 Chronicles 34, 8 through 13 now, tells us that upon the king's return to Jerusalem, after having cleansed the land of idols and looking to the next proper step in the service of God, he determined that the next act should be the repair of the temple. Although his grandfather, Hezekiah, had also cleansed the temple and repaired the doors, it appears that subsequently it had been entirely neglected. Supports and rafters were even broken and damaged. And so donations were invited for the repair, and the work was carried out to its completion. It was with Josiah's public work that manifested the condition of his heart. And it should be a kind of heart work with all who present themselves to the Lord. They should first begin by utterly destroying the fleshly idols of the heart. As the Apostle suggests in 2 Corinthians 7:1, put away all filthiness of the flesh and the spirit of perfecting holiness in the reverence of the Lord. One must seek the Lord personally. Break down the idols of his own heart and begin a cleansing work in his own life before he can take hold of the repairs of the great antitypical temple and do a work on behalf of others. Before Hezekiah, there was Ahaz. In his wicked rebellion, he had caused the manuscripts of the law to be burned, presumably all of them. However, in God's providence, perhaps with the cooperation of some faithful priests, one copy of the law was buried under a pile of stones surrounding the temple, or perhaps in a remote corner of one of the storage rooms in the temple itself. It is thought that this book was the five books written by Moses' hand and once kept in the very side of the Ark of the Covenant, and not just the book of Deuteronomy, as some commentators have suggested. Now, this remarkable document was uncovered during these detailed repairs of Josiah upon the temple. The account is found in this 2 Chronicles 34, verses 14 through 19, the finding of this book. When we remember that idolatry had flourished to a considerable extent for over 300 years, with only occasional reformations, realizing how far short Israel had come of the demands of the law, and noting the punishments prescribed in that law, we understand why the king was so troubled in this process of reformation in the land. And a moral may be drawn from all of this. At first, when we begin to seek the Lord, we recognize certain things and conditions of heart as sinful and requiring divine forgiveness and the necessity to put away, to the extent of our ability, all such things. Josiah destroyed the idols. But for us, it was only after we have been considerably exercised in the matter of reform in our lives and in connection with the temple class, the Lord's church, that the Lord supplied that clearer knowledge of his own perfection and the righteousness of his law, which enabled us to see that with all the reforms and cleansing set forth in his word, we still come far short of that standard. Thou shalt love the Lord with all thy being and thy neighbor as thyself. And as the king rent his garments and manifested greater contrition of heart after years of zealous service, so it is with the Christian who has passed through several stages of reform and whose mind at last discerns the true meaning of the great law of love. Then it is that he feels more than at first his shortcomings. While the world may be considering him some great reformer and some special saint, he himself has gotten to a place where he sees the majesty of the divine law and really his own undone condition. Only then it is that he also seeks the word of the Lord for guidance, instruction, and help. And just so it was provided for Josiah. So it was that the king gathered all the elders, Levites and people, small and great, both from Judah and Israel, those who survived the sieges of Assyrian deportation, for a reading of this marvelous law and covenant, which was the seal of their destiny, mentioned in 2 Chronicles 34, verses 31 and 32. how different the history of the Jewish people would have been had God's providences not brought this sole surviving copy to light. It survived their waywardness, and it revived and encouraged a faithful remnant, and was the basis for all future oral and written instruction. Copies were even carried into Babylon when the remainder of Judah were taken away in the days of Zedekiah. And so, Josiah seems to sense the great unifying power of the discovery of this public reading of the Pentateuch. His first care was to bring together the people, to acquaint them with the word of their heritage, to lead them to repentance in hope of averting the punishment. Moreover, now he set the priests in charge of reestablishing the Passover at the proper time and in all of its proper forms. The account is found in 2 Kings, the 23rd chapter, and in 2 Chronicles 35. We'd just like to read a couple of verses here in 2 Chronicles 35, 18 and 19. Then Shaphan the scribe told the king, saying, Hilkiah the priest hath given me a book. And Shaphan read it before the king. And it came to pass, when the king had heard the words of the law, he rent his clothes. I'm reading 34. 35th chapter, verse 18 and 19 is what I'm looking for. After these events of finding the law, he established the Passover. In the 32nd Chronicles 35, verse 18, and there was no Passover like to that kept in Israel from the days of Samuel the prophet, neither did all the kings of Israel keep such a Passover as Josiah kept. And the priests and the Levites and all Judah and Israel went that were present, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. In the 18th year of his reign of Josiah was this Passover kept. So notable was this Passover that Ezekiel even dates his prophecy from this event 30 years later. Ezekiel, the first chapter, verse 1 and 2. For Israel, it was, and the prophets that followed, it was considered the beginning of a new era. So, after the first step of purging the land and the temple, came the revealing of the law and the covenant to Israel. And the third step was to commemorate their deliverance and selection as a peculiar people with the Passover. All this seems to have been done with the most genuine of motives on the part of Josiah. 2 Chronicles 34, verse 33. And Josiah took away all the abominations out of the countries that pertained to the children of Israel, and made all that were present in Israel to serve, even to serve the Lord their God. And all his days they departed not from following the Lord, the God of their fathers. Yet we may be sure that then, even as in all other times, that there were a few that were deep in their convictions, and yet there were many that were shallow, of character, without a clear moral or religious conviction. Though Josiah continued his reform work, it was too late for any real national reformation. The nation had been tried for several centuries and found wanting according to the divine plan. The time was near when the typical kingdom would be fully overturned under Zedekiah. The insufficiency of mere reforms of worship may heal only the surface, but not the deep seat of a wound. Josiah did all that he could do, but he was working uphill. The reason for the impending judgments seemed to be given in 2 Kings 23, 26 and 27. 2 Kings 23, 26. Notwithstanding, the Lord turned not from the fierceness of his wrath, wherewith his anger was kindled against Judah because of all the provocations that Manasseh had provoked him withal. And the Lord said, I will remove Judah also out of my sight, as I have removed Israel, and I will cast off the city Jerusalem, which I have chosen, and the house which I said, my name shall be there. No reformation can be genuine which is only legislated or instituted by authority that is unaccompanied by a converted and a contrite heart. This reform was a movement on the part of the king rather than the nation. Josiah's labors on behalf of a wayward people continued until occurred what Brother Russell said was one of the most disastrous conflicts in the history of Israel. It's in the foreword to the first volume, I think the first I page in the fourth volume, he mentions that phrase. The Assyrian Empire was in a weakened position with invasions of Medes and Scythians from the north, who Josiah also had to repulse, and also with the growing threat of the Chaldean Empire and its capital, Babylon. Babylon was gradually absorbing the domain of Assyria and would soon dominate the last two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, had just fallen to Nabopolassar, the father of Nebuchadnezzar. Pharaoh Necho, the king of Egypt, saw an opportune time to join the flagging Assyrian empire, to repulse the Chaldeans and gain for himself the Assyrian domain, including all of Israel. At this time, primarily Judah. In his rush to Carchemish on the Euphrates River, he was determined to pass through the north regions of Israel and avoid a longer indirect route. And here he sends to Josiah a message in 2 Chronicles 35, 21 and 22. He says, he sent ambassadors to him saying, what have I to do with thee, thou king of Judah? I came not against thee, thee this day, but against the house wherewith I have war. Assyria and Babylon. I came not against thee this day, but against the house wherewith I have war. For God commanded me to make haste. Forbear thee from meddling with God, who is with me, that he destroy thee not. Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself that he might fight with him, and hearken not unto the words of Necho from the mouth of God, and came to fight in the valley of Megiddo. Also verse 25 we might read, and Jeremiah lamented for Josiah. This is after his death, which we will cover in a moment. And all the singing men and the singing women spake of Josiah in their lamentations to this day, and made them an ordinance in Israel. And behold, they are written in Lamentations. Some have regarded Josiah's response as ignoring God's counsel and giving assent to Pharaoh's charge of meddling. Even Brother Russell so characterized it in a question book comment, and I don't remember the page. But Chronicles has given only the highest marks of character to this Josiah. He is lamented as a truly noble and righteous ruler, and is gathered in peace with his fathers in fulfillment of Huldah's prophecy, and he is given a royal burial in Jerusalem. In these verses that we've just read, the Septuagint reads that Josiah made himself strong for battle instead of the word disguised. Disguised leaves the thought of a deception. Other translations use the word disrobed in the sense of that of setting aside his royal attire in the sense of putting on battle garments. I don't particularly see any deceit in Josiah's conduct in this battle. And we see no reason to believe the words that Pharaoh spoke were inspired by Jehovah, while the righteous Josiah is cast as defiant of God's edicts. Others would say that Josiah was ambitious of his own ends to obstruct an Egyptian-Assyrian alliance, wishing to cast his lot with the Babylonians. But here also, we see no such intrigues or defiance in Josiah. Egypt was simply trying to gain a foothold in the north. Josiah knew that should Egypt prevail, his independence would be at an end. And Pharaoh had no right to use Israel as a corridor for his own ends. It was a defilement of Josiah's purging program for him, for Josiah to become a party to any other nationalistic interests. Both Assyria and Egypt were fighting for survival and wanted to use Israel for their own ends, as a pawn. Josiah apparently remembered the counsel of Isaiah to Hezekiah when Israel was threatened from Assyria. Hezekiah took false security in alliances with Egypt. This was likely the basis of Isaiah 8, verses 9 through 12. Say ye not a conspiracy. Say ye not a confederacy, rather. Isaiah urged not to trust in such a broken reed, Isaiah 36, verse 6. But also when faced at the gates with Sennacherib's army, he encouraged Hezekiah to be strong in the Lord and not to collaborate. And that's exactly what Josiah was doing. He would not be a party to any collaboration. Here Josiah seems to assert independence of being used by any other party in their own struggles. We think Pharaoh's message was not from Jehovah, but of his own God, not Josiah's God. Josiah was not swayed. The testimony is that he turned not to the right nor turned to the left. But now a tragic turn of events occurred here in 2 Chronicles 35, verse 23. And the archers shot at King Josiah, and the king said to his servants, "Have me away, for I am sore wounded." His servants therefore took him out of that chariot and put him in the second chariot that he had, and they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died and was buried in one of the sepulchres of his fathers, and all Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. It is our thought, it is my own thought, that the forces of Israel were not as courageous in their convictions as was Josiah, their king and leader. And that somehow being left exposed in the battle, he was a marked man. Notice the words in 2 Kings 23, verse 29. In his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went against the king of Syria to the river Euphrates, and the king Josiah went against him, and he slew him at Megiddo. And this last phrase, when he had seen him. When Pharaoh Necho had seen Josiah. This was not a disguise. Somehow I think that the elite defensive forces that would normally surround the king had lost courage in the battle, and Josiah, in his own zeal, in pressing forward, was left exposed and caught the arrow of Pharaoh's forces. Being exposed, he was a marked man, much in the sense that Jesus was. Jesus also was courageous in battle and left to the devices of the enemy by those that should have rallied to his defenses. And in this sense, we think that Josiah is a picture of Christ. We'll return to this theme in a moment. Israel mourned so greatly because they not only lost a great king, but their nation. They really lost their nation in this one battle. They only now realized it too late to have followed his reform of heart and stand courageously with their example and leader. In this way also, we see Josiah as a picture of Jesus, abandoned in the prime efforts of his reform. With the battle of Carchemish on the Euphrates, two ancient empires fell. Assyria passed away forever, and Egypt never became a first-rate power. With the death of Josiah, the throne temporarily passed under the domination of Egypt. Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, was now brought to the throne. Then, under the ascendancy of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar appointed Zedekiah. After Josiah, it was only dying time for the spiritually weak nation of Israel. At this point in our original lesson, we had pointed out some time parallels of the era of Josiah to Zedekiah. Normally, we count 2,520 years from Zedekiah to the year 1914. Brother Julian Gray pointed out a number of other parallels and synchronisms of 2,525-year units from various points. And we'll, for the sake of time, I think, pass those, and it's not important to the lesson that we have. But now let us note some lessons for natural Israel. In Volume 4, the foreword, Brother Russell lists four typical events that occurred in Megiddo. There was Gideon and the Midianites. Saul was defeated by the Philistines. Jezebel also met her death here. And fourthly, Josiah was slain by Necho in Megiddo. He alludes to the interpretation of the three, but omits any comment about this Josiah, although mentioning it. Perhaps we find a clue in Zechariah 12. Zechariah 12, verse 2. Zechariah 12, 2, and also 8 through 11. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto the people round about, when they shall be in the siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem. 8 through 11. In that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them in that day shall be as David, and the house of David shall be as God, as the angel of the Lord before them. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. In that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem as the mourning of at Hadad Rimmon in the valley of Megiddo. It was here, I think the occasion being referred to in the history of Israel is that when Josiah was pierced and struck down by an arrow. He was the nation's last hope for spiritual revival. With him departed their national hopes. Might it be, in Israel's final confrontation, when both Eastern and Western societies seek to exploit Israel for their own survival, as did Nebuchadnezzar and Necho, when the West tries to bolster its feeble alliances and the discontents of Eastern Bloc countries burst forth, and organized religion gasps its last boasts, that each will look to Israel as the corridor to their survival, and that Israel will refuse passage as did Josiah. May it be that then, as the battle begins to go poorly, they will remember how they once abandoned their spiritual visionaries, Josiah and Jesus, how they abandoned Josiah exposed in the battle for their own hardness and fearfulness of heart. That principle of heart and faith, and not military might, were the tools that could have delivered them and must be realized now, or else abandon all hope in this last conflict. We believe the ancient worthies, as earthly representatives of the Messiah, will point the way and the lesson in recalling this lesson of their own history. And through Josiah, they will see Jesus. Then they will weep for him, Jesus, as they did for Josiah in Megiddo, and also for their own lack of allegiance to their own son, Messiah. In this broken heart condition, God will turn unto them, Zechariah 1:3. He will fight for them as in the day of battle, Zechariah 14:3. When they enter the defense as now the courageous tools of the Lord, as they failed in the past, God will be with them. Thus will God magnify himself in the eyes of many nations, Ezekiel 38:23. Only afterwards will Isaiah 19:23 be fulfilled. Isaiah 19:23-25. In that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria. And the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel mine inheritance. This no longer will be a contending for one's own identity, but Israel will be the bond after the battle. the people of the Western and socialist world will find then a corridor to learn of the God of Israel. Isaiah 2, verse 3. And many people shall go and say, come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And they will find the antitypical Josiah, and a people in gratitude, remembering the great Passover, once abandoned, but now reestablished with their discovery of the new law covenant and the Lamb of God. May the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Jerry, for bringing to light some experiences from the life of Josiah so that we might apply examples of his courage to our personal lives. We have a couple of brief announcements. Again, anyone that would like to volunteer for tonight's Vesper service, please assemble over here immediately following this service. Apparently, there's a car in the parking lot that has its lights on. It's a brown, copper-colored Buick. Actually, this announcement should have been given some time ago, so instead of having your lights on, your battery is now dead. And then also, a little bit of a change with our lunch program. We're going to have four lines instead of two to kind of speed the line along. Brother Jerry has selected hymn number 138 to close the service, and afterwards we'll ask Brother Jerry to close with prayer and also ask a blessing on the meal. Hymn number 138.
Thank you. Our gracious Father in heaven, hallowed be thy most holy name. We thank thee for the provision of thy word and the lessons of the past and the lessons of our own lives and the times and seasons in which we live. Help us to keep a careful eye to the progress of thy promises and word. We thank thee for the signs of the times, and also we thank thee for thy care for us and for natural Israel and for the provision for all mankind and the gift of thy Son. Please keep us humble and teachable and bless our fellowship together now that we may continue to grow in grace and truth. We ask for the forgiveness of our shortcomings. In Jesus' name, amen.